Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stuart Acuff with Utility Workers Union of America, asking you to tune in every time you can to Bob Carson's Carson's Corner, one of the best pro-labor shows in America. We love it at Utility Workers. We love it across the AFL-CIO, and we're grateful to Bob for coming on and holding up our issues and holding up our principles and values.
Live here on Carson's Corner with the Election Boycott Advocates. My name is Bob Carson. I hope everybody is well this Sunday evening, and we have a very, very special edition in the sense that Christopher Allen Driscoll, who really is a great resource for information. I mean, I know I speak for a lot of people when I say that I really learn a lot from Christopher. Just a wealth of knowledge, somebody that's been an activist going on decades, probably. Chris has probably been politically involved in groups and activities and raising consciousness for probably longer than I've been alive, okay? And that really, really says a lot. And he's not going to be with us here today on the show, so it's going to be me and Tom Baldwin from Biloxi, Mississippi, also Election Boycott Advocates member and author of the blog proactvoice.wordpress.com. Thomas, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Bob, good evening. How you doing?
Good, my friend. It's great to have you on the program. You and I are flying solo this evening. We're going to be broadcasting until about 10 p.m., and it's going to be different, but I think we can handle the job.
Well, I think we can, and, we'll miss Chris. I mean, he does add an awful lot, so... Anyway, we'll get him back on next week, hopefully, and we'll be back to pretty much normal. So, anyway.
Absolutely. And tonight there's a bunch of different things that we're going to discuss here. But first, I want to start off with a bit of an apology on my part, because in show description, I mentioned a article by Patrice Greenville, and I accidentally spelled Patrice's last name wrong. I spelled it with two E's as opposed to one.
I do that occasionally. Yeah.
You know, in any event, I did manage to get the name of the website right, and Patrice's last name is spelled Greenville. You'll have to forgive me. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning when I wrote the description, it wouldn't be Carson's Corner if there wasn't some mistakes or some difficulties. It's all part of the show.
That's right.
But in any event, Tom, you'd mentioned he wrote an article, a really, really good article that I had an opportunity to read last night or earlier this morning about the Western media's treatment of Vladimir Putin. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah. Well, this particular article that you wrote about was on PBS. And, we kind of have this ongoing expectation that PBS is going to be an objective and unbiased kind of source of information. And this particular article kind of really hit a nerve with Patrice, because he knows an awful lot about the situation in Russia and what's going on with the Ukraine and our proxy war that we're conducting there with the neo-Nazis. And so he really felt that they had done a hit job on Putin and on Frontline. And Frontline is generally pretty good show. I mean, I've seen it several times, and I don't watch it religiously, but when I do watch it, I usually have a pretty good show on. But this particular show just took off right at the beginning and essentially, you know, tried to document that Putin had a criminal, shady background and, you know, and I mean, most politicians do. I mean, you know,
right.
I was just thinking after I listened to it and after I read Patrice's article, I thought, my God, if they did an article like that on many of our leaders and including our presidents, you know, from birth to present state of affairs and show how they rose to power, I mean, they'd all look like criminals. I mean, you know, it's just really quite unbelievable. But anyway, you know, the main thing that the show did was really pointed out the details, some of the details at least, according to Frontline, of how Putin rose to power. And you know, he rose to power essentially during the 1990s after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Right.
And you know, the Soviet Union was essentially dissolved, and Russia was trying to get back on its feet, and you know, and they had some pretty unfortunate deals that their own leaders dealt out at that time, including in particular Yeltsin, and so Putin just happened to find himself, you know, working for some of those people. And one thing I noticed was, which I found kind of interesting, is that one of the criticisms that the Frontline had is that Putin had been loyal to his bosses, and essentially that helped him, you know, stay in good stead with people, and so they kept leaning on him for support when they needed it. And apparently he did a pretty good job, but he got, you know, he got entangled in some situations that he was basically being accused of doing. And whether he did them or whether he did them at the orders of his boss, we don't know. I mean, there are some situations that really, I guess he probably benefited from financially. But, boy, I just kept thinking about what our politicians do, and thinking about the, you know, the situation that we've had with our banks in the last 6 years, in which there's been all kinds of criminal activity, and nobody's been prosecuted, and you know, and they're still going free, and they're still, you know, spending money like it's going out of style, which it may be, but you know, they're trying to get theirs. And so I thought Patrice wrote a fairly fair critique of the show, and basically what he was trying to point out again, and several of us have done that in many times past, is point out how the corporate media, you know, just takes the so-called state position, whatever is. Dealt out at, in Washington, and you know, by, you know, the executive office, or maybe even a congressional office, but in particular an executive office, and takes the party line, you know, not the political party, but the state party, the corporatist party, and essentially feeds that to the media, and the media just puts it out, you know, without raising any questions about it. And, you know, we've talked several times about the situation in the Ukraine, but, man, I mean, that is just so outrageous what we've been doing there that it's unbelievable, you know?
Well, you know, it's really what I took from this article, and there are some points here that I really think are important, is that, you know, number one, PBS at one point used to be the bastion of so-called liberal thought. I mean, you used to have, you know, genuine programming, anti-corporate programming that used to shed light on some of the activities of our corporate government and our activities and whatnot. And then once you started to get ExxonMobil that started to advertise, you started to get the corporate sponsors, slowly but surely, you started to see more and more Republican shows, you know, right-wing shows and hosts out there. And now, you know, PBS has been infiltrated by the corporate media, no surprise. And, you know, the idea that we have fair and objective media is just, it's absolutely laughable. If you look at, you know, any major conflict in this country for the last 50, 60 years, or, you know, even going back before, going back to World War II, you never have an objective media. You never have media reporting from the places we're about to bomb. They don't get their,
right,
their information from, you know, like the Iraqi people, some people that supported Saddam Hussein in the lead up to the second Gulf War. You don't get that. What speaks to the absolute bias of the corporate media, and also relates to Noam Chomsky's propaganda model, which I am a real subscriber of, because I think that the way the media is structured, it's impossible for the American people to get the truth about the issue. There's just no question about that. And that all
yeah.
plays into what we saw here with this piece on the part of Frontline. It's because there are institutional pressures put against PBS and this show. If Frontline started to give you the opposing point of view, if they started to really go to Russia and speak to some, you know, supporters of Putin our activities there, it would present a much different picture to the American people. It would be honest, fair
yeah.
journalism, which doesn't exist in America.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they had a few interviews, you know, very few, but a few interviews on with some people who had gathered some data on Putin, and it was almost like they had gathered, you know, hearsay evidence and things that they could put in a notebook and maybe eventually do a book on, but they hadn't interviewed any key people either, so they were just kind of taking. Just be like somebody sitting down, and we wanted to do a hit job on somebody sitting down and interviewing us when we hadn't done any real research on the subject, you know, that we're just passing on what we've heard, you know, in the grapevine and then pass it on as truth. And so it was really hard to determine what was true and what was not true, I felt. And as I said, if Frontline had taken the time to do a story like that on George Bush or Obama, I mean, it'd probably come out the same way, because there were a lot of things
yeah.
that were never told us about, you know, those people when they first ran for office. We didn't know their history, and by the time they get ready to run for office, their entire image is totally determined by whatever marketing firm goes to work for them and builds that
yeah.
image and builds it up, and you don't know what has happened before. I mean, you never do, and it takes
yeah.
years for it sometime to come out. So,
well, you know, that's anyway. A very good point. As I pointed on the show, and Paul Street pointed this out in his latest book, Obama won Marketer of the Year. Actually,
yeah,
I know. You know, and it goes to the point you're making, how, you know, these politicians have brand makers, and they have people telling them what to say
yeah.
and telling them what to do. Everything's poll tested. You know, Ronald Reagan famously used to speak in front of four teleprompters, one on each side, to make it look like he was addressing the audience, and there wasn't a word in the teleprompter that he may have had some you know, influence over what went out, but ultimately this was written for him by his handlers, and it's the same thing.
Yeah.
And, you know,
yeah.
it's one of those things where it's impossible to trust these politicians, because they're only concerned about their image. They're only concerned really about their brand and whatnot. And, you know, and because of this, we had a guy, Andrew Craig, on the program last year. I may look to get him on. He's done a lot of investigative reporting into President Obama. And, you know, because of this, the American people think President Obama was this community organizer, this
yeah.
black radical from Chicago. But in actuality, if you look at his associations. You look at people like Genevieve Cook, who he dated a billionaire. Her father was a billionaire from Australia, was highly active in Australia's intelligence gathering, and she came from a mining company. He was involved with a guy named Percy Sutton, who was Malcolm X's attorney, but Percy Sutton, you could read all about this in Andrew Craig's book, Presidential Puppetry, Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. He actually recorded a promo for the show. And it's unfortunate because, you know, the truth about these people, it breaks the corporate narrative.
Yeah, it really does. And, and once they get their hands on the candidate that they want to control that image as well as they can. You know, they just they don't want the truth to get out about this situation. So, I mean, you know, all of the stuff that's been reported in the last, well, I think mostly in the last two or three years, maybe even some of it before that, that never made it to the press, but about Obama's parents and their relationships with rather interesting people, you know, And so he was a designee, I think, pretty early on, and at a fairly, probably a fairly young age, and then he proceeded along, educational path that they needed to give him academic credibility and make him look like somebody else entirely. But I just have this image that, you know, about a year or so from now, maybe a year before he goes out of office, people are just going to spill the beans all over the place. I mean, they're just going to go wild. And
it's unfortunate. Obama's poll numbers, and this is a manifestation of corporate media and just the economic abstractions that unfortunately the American people really buy into, because the corporate media is so important in the, quote, democratic process. They tell us who matters. They tell us what matters. And that's where pretty much everybody gets their news, with the exception of people like us who you know, are looking. If they're talking about one thing, we're talking about another thing. If they're telling us to read one thing, we're reading another thing. And so his poll numbers are up. And, you know, he's not going to be a liability to the Democrats, presumably from now until 2016, although a lot of people are predicting an economic collapse in 2016. You know how politics is, Thomas. It's one day it's one issue, it's another day it's another issue. It's whatever the corporate media, you know, wants to discuss. And so, if that remains the case, if the economy, the way it's presented to us, stays the same, Obama's out on the campaign trail with all these Democrats, then you're really not going to get any type of analysis into his background. You're really going to get this sort of immortalizing of President Obama, this glamorizing of President Obama, much like is the case with Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan, who you know these right wing think tanks and institutions spend hundreds of millions of dollars. There's a Reagan airport, a Reagan this. There's a Reagan landmark everywhere you go in the United States, even though Reagan's administration was one of the most corrupt administrations out there. And so, you know, as a result of this, the American people are by and large, as we've said, left in the dark about our politician. But, here's what I think, and this goes into what we also wanted to talk about, these free trade agreements that Democrats – and the Republicans are easy, eager to sign. This is all, Joe, this is all a house of cards, as we pointed out. Capitalism is at a dead end. The election system, the elections in America are just completely meaningless. And eventually consciousness will catch up to, consciousness will catch up to the American people. Events will spur consciousness, and that's what I think we're going to see, is that eventually people are just going to say, you know what, this is just absolutely meaningless. It really is.
Yeah, well, we're living in an Orwellian zone, you know, where truth is really kind of the last thing that we learn from the media, and So, you know, I think that eventually that's going to change. I mean, it just takes time for people to overcome the brainwashing that they've been getting and look at it objectively and look at it truthfully. And it really requires that we keep saying it. I mean, we have to keep telling the truth, because it's just like the reverse of brainwashing. You know, you do the opposite. And you know, I mean, Obama has adopted the war is peace philosophy, you know, from George Orwell. And you know, because everything we do, I mean, the stories that you get now in the alternate media of how many countries we're in right now with our special forces. And I think it was number of 130 mentioned this morning on one of the reports. And that's a repeat of something that had been reported before. But, you know, we're in 130 countries with special forces, and we're just messing things up to the point where we make war inevitable. And and it's perpetual war is what it is, and which is basically what we need to keep this empire going, because otherwise it would just fall flat on its face. But you're right about you know, I posted a thing on Facebook. I think I sent it to you. I don't know how I got it, but a window flipped up on me this morning, and talking about the economic situation, and there was this one guy that really seems to have a handle on it. I mean, he understands all the complexities of what's involved, and you know, this international thing and the trade relationships and the relationship with Russia and everything else is all tied up in this, because basically, we are, you know, like you said, a house of cards. And if they start to fall, that could happen really fast. I mean, it could really happen fast. And I don't know that we could stop it. I mean, we didn't stop the financial crisis in 2008 until it had already occurred. And we're not as well prepared to handle that situation again as we were even then, even though it was so hard. But the kind of crash that people are talking about next is one which is bigger than the much bigger than the Great Depression of the 1930s. And so it's a very, very discouraging situation, and it's hard to know, you know, how an individual should proceed, and certainly hard to know how organizations that want to change the situation should proceed. It's just not a simple formula. I mean, it really is a matter of keeping your eye and being vigilant on things on a day by day basis, and then seeing how you need to alter your plans. But you know, we've got to get busy. I swear, we've got to get busy. And well, and the one thing that I feel good about is the fact that we have at least stayed constant with our advocacy of election boycott as a primary method to deal with the corrupt political situation, because we've got to address that no matter what. So, anyway.
Oh, and I actually am in the process of, because I'm just getting more and more committed to our cause. And, you know, I each week I never, ever am going to get tired of reminding people about the system, speaking against the system, you know, speaking out against our elections, getting people to get, adopt the idea of noncompliance. And I'm actually going to be getting a bumper sticker, the Election Boycott Advocates bumper sticker, probably the first one in America, I would be willing to bet. It's going to have our website on it. It's going to be real thought-provoking for people that are behind my jalopy in the state of New Jersey. Let me tell you something. But you know what, Thomas? I want to expand on something you said just a moment ago. How, you know, you mentioned the financial collapse and how it's a house of cards, and you know, we have to focus on things day to day, and we keep on keeping on. We have to basically, you know, just shout at the top of our lungs to anybody that will listen. Well, what I've done, what I've really, really started to do, and it really has been beginning to take place over the last few months. I mentioned the book I just read, Capitalism at a Dead End, by
right.
Fred Goldstein. And right. I'm going to start to really read some of his work, because a lot of what is happening right now is everybody is depreciating. We're just completely depreciating. Technology has rendered skills useless, okay? Free trade, the very free trade agreements that we've been talking about, they continue to render our skills useless in a race to make labor, the labor pool, very, very cheap and controllable, as is the case under our system of labor control here and elsewhere. You have all of these different modes of control that the ruling class have to basically immobilize American workers. And the reason why this is taking place, it's because of the very system itself. I think that we need to really analyze, I think, the economic system and say that basically we're in a perpetual, you know, you mentioned perpetual state of war. Well, we're in a perpetual state of economic decline where capitalism,
right.
to keep up with the declining rate of profit, and basically in a general sense, that is that the capital is becoming more expensive for the capitalist owners, okay, every single day because of the competitive nature of capitalism, which requires owners to intrude on competitors' markets and gobble up their profits and keep up with the rising cost of capital. So the way to do that is to do what they're doing now, bring us back into the abyss, you know, cut workers, cut hours. Austerity,
right.
Closed stores. You look at a retailer like Target. Target is closing hundreds of stores in America. Thousands of workers are going to be laid off. You have the automation, as I mentioned, of our system. You know, Walmart automated system, Ann Taylor, all these retailers. It's all automated now, and computers and technology is making labor so efficient, but labor is not producing anything, which is a real contradiction in the capitalist system. And this is ongoing. This is going to continue. Because we have an economic system that is based on profits. And when profits increase, then supposedly more workers will be hired. When they decrease, more workers will be fired. But because of technology, Thomas, the rate of hiring cannot keep up with the rate of firing. And this is a constant now. And so the only way for the capitalist out there to really keep up with the rising cost of capital is to make the workers pay. And that's what they're doing. They're making us pay.
Yeah.
And once American workers realize that they have nothing in store, there's nothing in store for them with this economic system, then maybe we could start to really change things. But I think we need to really focus our efforts on, you know, in one cause, one thing. The election boycott advocates, it's a way to get people to stop participating in the election system, which is meaningless. Stop supporting two capitalist parties, okay, that are selling us out no matter who's in office, okay, and focus on real radical reform, which is what we need.
Yeah, I agree completely, Bob. I mean, I have been, you know, that's kind of been my path for some time, and you know, and the starting point has to be to, you know, where we are, I think, with respect to the election boycott advocates. We have to stop the corruption and the evil. Really, it is evil that's going on within the political system. And, I mean, these people are just enriching themselves is all they're doing. And, you know, they bought into the capitalistic system, and they're a part of it, and they're the...
Yep.
They're the voice, really, of the capitalists, and they're projecting that voice, and you know, essentially doing all the advertising and continuing to take us down this path, and they just apply it to their own political system, you know, that's a dead end street. I mean, there's no doubt it's a dead end street, and it's only a question of how fast. You know, and, you know, Republicans might make it happen faster, but that's okay because then at least people will see it. And so, you know, I don't feel badly. I mean, I don't let them use that fear mode anymore of you've got to vote, you know, this way because if you don't, these bad guys will get in. Hell, they're all bad guys.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you know, that rationale is so stupid. You know, you're not going to vote for Democrats because they're accomplishing anything. You're voting for Democrats because they're going to stop something worse from happening. That's the rationale.
That's right.
And I got to tell you, it's so ridiculous. It really is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I took on somebody last week. I keep taking him on, this guy up in Pennsylvania that keeps trying to find some savior for the Democratic Party, and he first started out with Bernie Sanders. Now he's advocating for Elizabeth Warren, and I keep telling him it's not the candidates that we need to be changed. It's the whole system. It's the Democratic Party. It's the fact that they are the corrupt system. And they're going to continue to take anybody they get, anybody they try to essentially position for the thing, and they're going to mold that person into exactly what they want, and they're going to end up with somebody that's even worse than Obama. That's hard to imagine right now, but it was hard to imagine anybody worse than Bush.
that's right. And Hillary Clinton, you can make, would
Hillary
be worse
Clinton
than
is
Obama.
Much worse. She's
exactly.
much worse. Yeah,
and that's the thing is that you know what kills me, Thomas. I have Sirius XM in my car, okay, and I listen to sometimes it's called Sirius XM Progress 127. It's the so-called liberal station, and you these guys now, and all of them are like this. You can go down the list. Every single host on Sirius XM is essentially saying the same thing. That look what Obama's giving us now. Free college education. Obama's talking tax the wealthy. Obama's talking about vetoing the Keystone XL pipeline. Obama knows that these things have no chance of passing whatsoever. Obama arguably had the opportunity, if he were a real progressive, early on in his administration when his party controlled both houses of Congress. Obama had every single opportunity, but yet these people are a vetting system. They're Democratic shills. They continually praise this man in spite of what he's done for the past 6 years or so, and I find it absolutely disgusting. And people still buy this; they gobble up, Thomas.
Well, I first started really blogging seriously. I'd done a little bit, but I started blogging seriously in November, December of 2010. And you know, I was kind of semi-retired, or basically retired, but semi-retired, and when Obama was elected in 2008. And so I really started paying much closer attention to everything that was going on a daily basis. And, you know, we had our crises at the time. We had, we had Katrina, and that had happened before then. But then after Katrina, we had the BP oil spill in 2010. And you know, so I really got up on my soapbox and started to yell. And it was in November, December of 2010, after we'd gone through this whole bloodbath with respect to Obamacare and giving up a public option, and you know, a single payer was never really considered, but giving up a public option and essentially turning over the healthcare system to the pharmaceuticals and the insurance industries, and losing all control over costs. I mean, that was one of the big objectives of the healthcare, Obamacare or the ACA, was to try to control costs. And there was no cost control in the situation. In fact, the situation was going to only get worse. And you know, and the Democrats were, oh, gosh, this is wonderful. This is just great. This is grand. And, you know, it's like they hadn't even paid attention to what went on in that whole year and a half when the bill was being written. And then in November, December, Obama came in with a new Congress. Of course, the Tea Party had gotten a lot of control. But he came in and essentially in that 2 months after the election until the new Congress took place, he essentially started giving everything away with regard to taxes too. He gave up the tax situation with regard to the rich, and essentially
right.
gave them everything they wanted. And when he did that, I said, my God, I mean, this guy is going to turn out to be just a bomb. I mean, he really is for everything we thought he stood for. And he'd shown some other people that before me, but I tried to ride with him for a while. But, man, I mean, after that, after the fall of 2010, I said, never again. I mean, it's fool me once, shame on you, and fool me twice, shame on me, man.
Exactly. That's weird because that's exactly the time when I stopped supporting President Obama. And you recall during that time, Obama extended the Bush tax cuts for those, I believe, making over $400,000 a year. I forget what it was, but it was a far cry from the $250,000 that he had promised. And then on top of that, right around that time, he rose the pay of federal workers, which, again, is essentially a tax increase for federal workers, buying into the notion that it's federal workers that are somehow a drag on the economy. He supported the firing of the Rhode Island teachers. And, you know, that's exactly when I stopped supporting him. But I want to bring up 2 points here. You know, it's the last time we were on the election boycott here on Carson's Corner. Last Sunday, there was a report that was released that says, and I'm going off memory here, something like the world's 1% of income earners own 50% of all the nation's, all the world's wealth. Okay, you have something like 80 people which have an extreme amount of wealth, okay? That in itself says everything, is that that's the new normal of capitalism right there, where a small group of people own everything, and all of us are left to fight for the scraps coming off their table, and what does that do to society? What does that do to us? What type of results does that produce for our society? Secondly, you mentioned the BP oil spill, and Fred Goldstein wrote about this in his book, how basically, you know, the BP oil spill, and this is like a lifetime ago. You know, this happened in, 2010? You don't get any coverage of it. BP now is, you know, there was some talk about nationalizing BP after this happened, what should have happened. Now BP is you know, expanding their drilling, they've especially in the Gulf. And what that was a result of a business decision to save money off of a shutoff valve, and it had connections to Dick Cheney, our former vice president. It was Halliburton, his company that he was the CEO of. Okay, they wanted to save money off of a shutoff valve. And Fred Goldstein makes a really good point, is that under capitalism, the means of pollution are also the means of production. So when we see this climate march in New York, which we spoke about this on the show, in a sense it's null, but we have to really fight the real enemy here, which is the economic system that allows the owners, the capitalist owners, to exploit the nation's wealth. And that's a very, very important. It speaks to ownership in America. It speaks to our natural resource, which all of us own. In Alaska, there's the Alaskan Trust Fund, I believe it is, where the dividends from oil money that the state received is redistributed to the citizens. You know, think about if we did that on federal land here. Think about if we redistributed the resources that the capitalists suck out of our planet, how much better of a society will be. You know, I mean, this is
absolutely
what we've got to think here. This is why we got to really, I think, refocus the fight here and just go after, you know, one particular issue. We got to go after the tree that produces all of these poisonous branches.
Right. Yes, I agree. And, you know, we talked about social democracies last week. I think it was last week or whenever Perry was on. I keep forgetting which week it is now. But anyway, and we talked about the Scandinavian countries, and I think it's Norway that has essentially initiated a policy of dividing all the money that's derived from oil, and it's an oil-rich nation, right. being in the in that area. They're taking all the money that is derived from oil in the ground, essentially, all the profits anyway, that and dividing it up equally among their residents. And there was an article about this some months ago, that every
right.
resident was essentially now worth $1 million.
Wow.
And you know, I mean, it just shows what you could do if you decide that, you know, that that money or those resources belong to all of us. I mean,
right.
That, you know, it's in the earth, man. I'm sorry. But
yeah.
They belong to all of us. And you know, that situation with regard to that inequities with regard to wealth, it's important to emphasize, too, that we're not just talking about the United States here. We're talking about
yeah.
what's the situation worldwide, you know,
right.
and, you know, a handful of people, maybe a few dozen people have as much wealth as 3 billion people have, you know,
yeah,
or more, maybe more. And, you know, the study by Oxfam that was just done recently, you know, pointed out that the situation's getting worse. And that those people are going to have as much money as more money, actually, the curves cross in about 2 years. By 2016, are going to have more money than
yep.
99% of the people in the
yep.
On Earth,
and,
you know. So.
And in the United States, this is happening under a so-called progressive president. And, again, this is the new normal of capitalism here. This is
yeah.
the ruling class. Extracting more and more and more money. The you know, think about a business owner in America, okay? You know, I always laugh because in the corporate media we're bound to respect businessmen, we're bound to respect entrepreneurship, the entrepreneurial spirit and whatnot. But think about a businessman in America, where if you're a businessman, your amount of profit. The amount of profit you'd make, which is perpetual life, it basically is endless, okay? You could potentially make 500 times your lowest paid worker. You could potentially make whatever that amount is. And yet your only responsibility is to pay your worker a wage
yeah.
which you deem is allowable, which you deem is sufficient. And think about, you know, the effects that has on just everybody. Think about the what type of results that produces. You know, I always liken it back to a kindergarten class. We can picture a kindergarten class. Well, imagine if you had one or two people in that kindergarten class that had all the toys, had all the crayons, had all of the chairs, had all
yeah.
of the paper, and would not share the materials with the other classmates. And not only that, is reinforced by the teacher, is reinforced, in this case the teacher would be the equivalent of the corporate media, is reinforced, this type of behavior is reinforced, right? What type of results, what do you think, how do you think that's going to affect the all the other kids in that class? You're going to have crying, you're going to have fights, you're going to have everything that we see in the capitalist system right now. And
yeah.
it's the new normal of capitalism. It's going to get worse and worse and worse. And to make up for the declining rate of profit, what's going to happen is these capitalists are going to come after us with Social Security. They already have, as you know, Thomas, they're going to come after us with Medicare raising the retirement age. They've already convinced
yeah.
Most of white America that we need to raise the retirement age. It's going to be more austerity, more tax breaks for the very wealthy, to the point where, you know, you have a handful of people in this country that own 80% of the wealth. And it's important to realize that the 1% that they're talking about here, Christopher talked about this, we talked about this maybe a few weeks on this program, how these people are sick, they're never going to be satisfied with the amount of wealth they have.
No.
Out of the driven, to the point where these people are completely apathetic to anybody that is not in their class. Their life is defined by how much goddamn money they have at the expense of society. That's what it all comes down to. And that's why it's never going to stop unless we stop them.
Yeah. Well, money and power, the combination, and
yes.
they usually go together. but they're basically addictive qualities. I mean, you know, the people that acquire it always want more. And, you know, and they don't want anybody to stop them. And, and so it just grows and grows until it finally becomes a complete obsession and completely dominates the behavior of, you know, the person that's practicing it. And so they don't give a damn what ills are caused to anybody else. Because at that point, they're not capable of even considering that. I mean, that's not even in their value system at that point. And, you know, we had a discussion, a little discussion about that online today with Patrice and a couple of others from the Greenville Press and Greenville Post. And we were talking about, you know, how we have to start talking again about values. And, you know, and we don't teach them, you know, we've talked about how we need to teach them in the elementary schools and emphasize them there, but we... you know, we confuse family values with just human values, just basic intrinsic human values. And so, you know, I think it is important that we keep discussing those and the importance of them, because that's where we're in primary competition with the capitalists. I mean, they have a different set of values. I mean, it's profit, man. I'm sorry. It's profit.
And look at the 1%. Look at the media, you know, Noam Chomsky talk, compare, get a newspaper and compare labor section with the business section. There's there's no labor section, okay?
No, there
everything that we absorb, and there used to be in America, I mean, you could go back, you know, several decades, there used to be, but now labor is an impediment to business. Everything's through the lens of big business. Everything is the lens of the 1%. And so that's why we have this value system. And this value system is reinforced every single day in the form of advertisements, in the form of television shows, in the form of everything you see, read, or hear on the corporate media. And that's why it's so difficult to challenge the system, because everybody is indoctrinated by the system by merely picking up a newspaper or watching television. That's why it's so important to break away from that. That's what I do. I haven't owned a television since 2008 because everything, you know, when I watch YouTube, I watch a YouTube video, I see a YouTube commercial, you know, advertising some product, and again, I see messages, subliminal messages being broadcasted designed to gain your compliance. And that's what we have to do, is we have to educate people that this is happening at your detriment. You're being told that you have to consume. Being told that you don't want to just have a car, you want to have a Mercedes, you want to be a want person. You don't have to address needs. We don't have to address needs. We want everybody to be a want person. We want everybody to have the big house with the Hilton and be this Donald Trump or the next entrepreneur or this and that.
Yeah.
Forget about needs. Forget about, you know, whether the economic system of capitalism is designed to address human needs. No, that doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, the problem is that that capitalism is now, and they're already making progress in this, is now turning to human needs and trying to get control of those things too. I mean, you know, there's a lot of concern right now that well, the energy thing has been going on forever, and it's still going on right now, and. But we're looking at things like water and, you know, and how corporations are going to try to get control of water. And, you know, and we know they're trying to do it with food. And so basically all the human needs that are necessary for our existence basically are being taken over by the corporations as they grow. And as they get more and more power, and as they reach out into new areas that they have not been involved in before, and this whole effort that they're pushing in the states and now, and they have been pushing it at the national level, but at the state level, they're pushing privatization and letting them get control of basic domestic needs, including the utility industries. And you know, it's like a huge cancer, you know, that's just they're sweeping through the nation, and people have got to wake up and look at it and say it's got to stop. It's just got to stop. And so, you know, the question is, how do we stop it? And so, you know, we've got to obstruct. That's what we have to do. We have to basically put our bodies in place and say it's got to stop. And
the corporate media has really gotten rid of the Ferguson protests, much like they did, you know, to a certain extent with the Occupy movement, where you just, you know, we saw the rebellion, and the corporate media, you know, I'm not sure to what extent there even are protests out there. I'm sure there are rallies out there because, you know, the police force is a constant. As the crisis becomes more prolonged, as, you know, capitalism just deteriorates the lives of American workers, you're going to see police, you know, shootings on the rise. You're going to see the level of incarceration increase. And so, you know, you have this system that is just, you know, completely corrupt. But this is, you know, where we find ourselves now, where all of this is just basically a constant out there. You know, it's not going to get any better. We are going to have to put our bodies on the line. You know, I admire, there was a time in America where you had workers dying in strikes, you know, workers being shot down by, you know, by the National Guard. And in 1919, the Great Red Year, I believe, where one out of five workers were striking in America, you had the militancy of organized labor, which, you know, there was a time in America where organized labor was completely diminished, even more so than it is now. And they rose up. But they put their body on the line. The level of consciousness was much different than it is now. But we could get that point. We get to that point. You know, the Occupy protests, even though the Ferguson rebellion was basically squashed, that sent them the feeling that this is a rigged system, the feeling that workers have no skin in the capital system, still exists out there. And that's going to really rise to the top one way or another, Thomas. People are going to eventually have, no, you know, we're through with this, as Christopher said, and it's time to offer people a viable alternative. And that we should really start focusing on, too, is what we did. We have been. It's not like, you know, we spoke about the BRIC countries this week with Perry Merrill, which, by the way, that should very well, people really enjoyed that discussion. That's what we have. Is set people up for an alternative there.
Yeah, I wish, you know, and I guess I can just keep wishing, but I wish the labor movement would show some initiative, and, you know, and that they, maybe the people in the labor movement would rise up against their own bosses and basically say, look, you're not doing anything for us anymore, and we've got to get out there and do something for these people that need to get organized as well, like places at Walmart and, you know, with a million workers. And we ought to be out here, you know, really spending our time out here supporting these people. I mean, that's what should go on. And you know, I think if they do that, and we could also ask the consumers support them, you know, I think we get a number of consumers that would support them. I mean, you're maybe not a majority, but at least a goodly number that would say, yeah, well, we understand why they need to earn more money, because they're not able to support their families this way, and they have to maintain two or three jobs at this rate, and have no benefits in the process, and, you know, get a general kind of awareness on the part of the public that that these people who are giving you low prices are also, you know, doing it on the backs of their workers, and in this case, doing it with imported goods that are manufactured by people making less than a dollar a day, You know, I mean, people need to hear that story over and over and over again so that they understand that they're part of the problem when they continue to support these businesses, you know?
Well, you know, it goes back to what you're talking about, the value system, where basically, you know, everything is consumer-driven. It's about consuming, you know, supporting the system. And, you know, because of that, you see advertisements designed to get you to, you know, consume products or, you know, we're better in the capitalist system because we have an iPhone. I'm better in the capitalist system because the price of a laptop has gone down significantly since it was first introduced to the market. Somehow I'm better. Somehow I'm defined by the level of technology that's out there, which is all owned by the capitalist owners, not owned by we the people who ultimately created this technology. No, it's owned by Bill Gates. It's owned by somebody with the name the title owner attached to them. And that's what we have to really emphasize, is that we're not better off because we could save a couple pennies on some paper towels at Walmart. It's the exact opposite. We're worse off because of there's no unionization. We're worse off because we have a system of labor control. We're worse off because of capitalism. That's what we have to highlight. We got 60 seconds left, my friend.
Okay. I thought we might be able to talk about a little more about Russia and the trade agreements, but we can do that next week. That'd be a good subject. And, you know, because this TPP and this fast track thing are coming up, and they're coming up fast. And we're going to be in over our heads real fast about, with all the stuff that's going on in Congress behind our back. We're not knowing what's going on, you know, so.
Absolutely. The time went by very, very fast. We started maybe a couple minutes late, but we really were long. A very passionate discussion here. I want to encourage everybody to check out Thomas's work at proact.voice.wordpress.com, proactvoice.wordpress.com. Also, check out the Election Boycott website at electionboycott.weebly.com. And check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/electionboycottadvocates. We'll speak to Christopher Allen Driscoll, who's listening, next week. Thomas, it's great to speak to you. And hopefully we'll have a guest on next week. If not, it'll be the Election Boycott Advocates exclusively on Cars Corner.
Well, we'll see what we can do. Thanks, Bob.
Take care, man.
Yeah, good night.
Bye-bye.